Hello, you're listening to Copy Time, a podcast series on markets and economies from DBS Group Research. I'm Temur Beg, Chief Economist. Welcome to our 47th episode. Today, we will talk about perhaps the most complex and critically important product in the modern world, semiconductors. They are in everything we use, and they're also at the heart of the great power tech rivalry. To delve into this fascinating subject, we're lucky to have with us Dan Wang. Dan writes on China's technology progress and the effects of U.S. regulatory actions. In particular, he tracks China's semiconductor capabilities, U.S. measures on export controls, the pace of supply chain relocation, and broader tech industrial policy. Dan has given keynotes for a variety of organizations, and his work is widely cited in the press. He's a contributor to Bloomberg Opinion. Dan Wang, welcome to Copy Time.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Hey, it's great to have you. I would like you to help our listeners to just lay out the basic facts on the world of semiconductors and all that's going on. So if you could just give us a sense of, you know, who are the leading companies and countries in the area of both development and production of semiconductors?
A very big question indeed. So semiconductors are one of the most complex, if not the single most complex technology industry in the world. And you have basically quite a few companies and quite a few countries basically involved in every aspect of production. So if I'm thinking through basically the way that, silicon is rendered into wafers and then transformed into particular dyes and then gets turned into integrated circuits, roughly the way that I think about it is this. So, you know, just let me list a few countries one by one. So Korea is maybe the most straightforward. So the Korean firms, namely Samsung and SK Hynix, are really good at making memory chips. Taiwan is fairly straightforward as well. It has a major company, TSMC, that actually manufactures a lot of the semiconductors. And then it also has a few more design firms. Europeans have mostly lost a lot of their semiconductor capabilities, but they are still strong in two broad areas. The first is production of semiconductor manufacturing equipment, namely ASML in Holland. Basically, it is still very good at making quite a few types of industrial chips, namely things like auto chips. That makes pretty good sense given that Europe is still very much an auto-heavy producing country, a very auto-heavy producing continent. And there are still certain European firms involved in parts of the chemicals and gases that are really important for semiconductors. Now, maybe the two most interesting countries are, first of all, the US, and then second of all, China. So the US more or less invented the integrated circuit back in the 60s with a lot of procurement from the Department of Defense. Today, it is a little bit less dominant in a lot of different types of semiconductor technologies, but it is still, I would say, the most important player in so many different aspects. So, you know, there are so many different semiconductor design firms in California where I used to work. These are names like NVIDIA and Broadcom and Qualcomm, and Apple is now a very important chip design firm. These include things like companies like Intel and Micron, who are still some of the world's manufacturing leaders today, even though both Intel as well as Micron have seen a little bit of better days. And maybe the most important part of the US supply chain is its dominance of the equipment and technologies to actually manufacture and design semiconductors. So in order to design an integrated circuit, you need something called EDA tools, which is a part of the software to really try to design these integrated circuits. And this is almost entirely an American affair dominated by firms like Cadence, Synopsys, and Mentor. And then in addition, you need, after you have the designs in place, you need to actually manufacture the semiconductors. And this is where the Americans are still very dominant. You have firms like Lam Research, KLA Tencor, and Applied Materials that are very big players. And where does China fit in? Well, China is starting to get fairly good at designing chips. Huawei is a very competent outfit, at least at designing and chips for its own smartphones. China is beginning to have a little bit of a position on memory. It is beginning to have basically, coming up to catching up to the technological frontier, the actual manufacturing of semiconductors, but it's still very far behind in terms of the software as well as the equipment to actually manufacture chips. And so, you know, the interesting story over the next decade will be to see exactly how quickly China can actually catch up to the US in pretty much every segment that the US is good at, because China is very keen to have technologies that the US is almost the sole provider, and it is not necessarily having an easy time buying things in these political conditions.
Is Japan part of this picture at all?
Japan is a very big part of this picture, and I'm sorry to have neglected it. Japan used to be a very big producer of semiconductors, but actually a lot of the semiconductor companies have mostly faded away. And where Japan is still very important is part of the capital equipment process. So like Europe, it is producing quite a lot of the chemicals and gases, as well as a lot of the actual silicon wafers to actually manufacture semiconductors. And it is pretty important still for semiconductor manufacturing equipment. So Tokyo Electron is one of the big companies out there manufacturing a very critical part of the semiconductor production equipment process.
And you mentioned the phrase faded several times, both in the context of the US, and now you just mentioned in the context of Japan. And even in the case of Europe, you said that, you know, it used to be a big powerhouse and has sort of ceded some of its prowess. So explain the dynamics of integrated circuit manufacturing over the last 30, 40 years. Why did it sort of shift away from certain places and migrate to some other places?
That's absolutely one of the most fascinating aspects of this industry, in which you see particular firms rise up and then fade away. You see basically industrial leadership pass between various countries in a way that is not very typical, for example, of the computer industry or the software industry, which are very much dominated by the US ever since the earliest days. And so semiconductors looks a little bit more like machine tools, in which US and UK had the earliest leadership, moved on to Japan and Germany, and now I think sort of moving on to China. And so, there are absolutely a lot of fascinating stories here, but they may be a little bit more of micro stories. So Intel in the 80s was really a firm manufacturing DRAM memory chips. And it was basically mostly had its butt kicked by the Japanese, who were able to make much better DRAM chips than even Intel was. The Koreans then, through the 80s, managed to catch up to Japan with some American
help. I'm going to interrupt you for a second. When you say that they were much better, the Japanese chips, because they were cheaper or better quality?
Better quality, especially. So the American chips were diffuse. They were not so heavily capitally concentrated, whereas the Japanese firms sort of figured out the technology and then had much better quality of manufacturing than the Americans and were much bigger in scale than the American players. Now, same story played out with South Korea relative to Japan. South Korea now is very much dominant in memory chips. And then Taiwan entered the picture by getting very good at being a foundry only. So it did not design substantial amounts of its own chips. It was simply a manufacturer. And that's sort of a bit of the Taiwanese story in a nutshell in so many other ways. Taiwanese firms are very good at producing things that are not branded by their own firms, producing goods that are for example, American companies like Apple. And so, you see basically industrial leadership pass between different countries, pass between different companies, sometimes going in the same direction, sometimes going in the opposite direction. And now China is very intent on challenging everything that basically the Koreans, Japanese, Taiwanese, Americans, and Europeans are good at.
Okay, I definitely want to get into the Chinese story momentarily, but I'm fascinated by TSMC, and I've heard you in other fora talk about the journey of TSMC. How on earth did a single company in this highly lucrative competitive field become such a big dominant player? And also give our listeners a flavor of how dominant are they right now?
Right. So TSMC, if you just take a look at market share, I believe manufactures around 50% of all semiconductors in the world. And I think that still understates how important it is, because these are some of the most advanced chips out there. So a major firm like NVIDIA, which has become so important as part of this artificial intelligence story, for a very long time only gave orders to TSMC, and you know, not really favoring its competitors, TSMC's competitors, with firms like UMC, for example. And so TSMC had a bit of a head start early on over a couple of its competitors, like UMC, like SMIC in China. And then it's really been able to compound that difference. And so, you know, every semiconductor success story looks alike. You know, you have these companies that make monopoly margins, they're able to invest for future rounds of R&D. When everyone else catches up, then they drop those monopoly margins onto commodity margins. Whereas every semiconductor failure is kind of a failure in its own special way. But there are a couple of companies that have really enjoyed this virtuous cycle of really being on the technological frontier, earning monopoly margins in the first few years, and then using those monopoly margins to fund future rounds of R&D. So these examples include Samsung, which is very specialized in memory, Intel, which does its own things, mostly involved in microprocessors for PCs as well as data centers, and then TSMC, especially. And TSMC, I think, has been the biggest beneficiary of this you know, fabless foundry model, in which you have a lot of firms, especially in California, just focused on the design, not doing committing any of their own capital to doing manufacturing, and then TSMC focuses exclusively on manufacturing. And this is something that has really compounded and worked out very well, in addition to just being a fantastically run company in Taiwan.
I want to ask you a couple of things about that issue related to manufacturing. How complex is manufacturing these latest generation of chips, and how expensive are they?
Well, maybe the best way to illustrate that is to by reference to an ASML machine. So ASML is the Dutch-based company that is making sort of the sole provider now of extreme ultraviolet lithography, EUV lithography equipment, which you need to make the cutting-edge chips, which today are around 3 to 5 nanometers. And so, you know, if you take a look at a particular ASML machine, each of them is about the size of a bus. It took about 30 years, really, of deep experimentation, as well as doing quite a bit of science to be able to create just a single one of these machines. You need about 3 airliners to transport one of these things, and they cost around $150 million to $200 million each. And, you know, just appreciating that particular machine as one, the most complex, but still one of a very complex value chain of different technologies required to produce semiconductors, it's really tough to, you know, wrap one's mind around each of these things. You need gases and chemicals that are extraordinarily pure. You need silicon wafers that have no bits of corruption inside. You need very skilled engineers who have been working extensively with these things to, you know, think through the light physics and chemistry really to be able to produce a chip. Everything here is, you know, makes up a lot of the most complex processes that we know in the technological world.
And how much money are we talking about for the latest foundry that TSMC has built?
Well, TSMC announced, I need to check my figures here, but it's something like $40 billion, I believe, in terms of capital allocation over the next year. I think that's about right. And, you know, for, you know, but even before this massive, you know, announcement of capital, for each of the last few years, the three leaders, namely Intel, Samsung, and TSMC, have been investing north of $15 billion each for, you know, each of the last few years. So this is an extremely capital-intensive industry. A new TSMC fab, I believe the 3-nanometer fab in Tainan, will cost something north of $20 billion for one particular factory. And I'm pretty sure these are the most expensive operations on Earth.
Wow. Okay, so Dan, I'm blown away by the, you know, dollar figures. But I'm also kind of intrigued by one thing you mentioned briefly about the smart engineers you need who are at the cutting edge of solid state physics and chemical engineering and electrical engineering. So it's not just that you need a lot of money, you need some really smart and capable engineers too.
You need smart and capable engineers who have very good experience actually working with these semiconductors. Otherwise, you have no hope of catching up to the leading edge. Now, you know, a semiconductor in theory is a very simple concept. You know, I can draw a perfect transistor for you, basically something that turns on and off. That does not mean I can produce something commercially. That does not mean I can, you know, produce something at any sort of reasonable cost that anyone wants to use. And so, you know, the semiconductor physics, I think, are pretty straightforward. But what, you know, challengers like China really lack are, you know, the very deep pools of knowledge that have worked very extensively with this technology, that have deep production experience, that know, you know, what goes wrong, how much chemicals to use, what sort of lighting conditions are best, that just have a lot of this tacit knowledge, what I think of as process knowledge. This deep experience with working through all of these things in basically a very intense and long-term way.
Now, earlier you mentioned that even in the 80s, Intel faced tremendous competition from Japanese manufacturers. And also in the last decade, anybody who looks at Intel's share price can tell that they've had a bit of a rough time in keeping up with their manufacturing prowess, even with this generation of chips. So, the U.S. is full of bright minds, as we have seen in the case of Silicon Valley. I'm sure there's, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of, you know, smart engineers coming out every year. I mean, why can't Intel hire them and put in a lot of money and keep pace with TSMC?
Well, this is comes back a bit to the experience question. And I think it is also worth thinking through, you know, what Silicon Valley is today and what it is not. Now, I used to live in San Francisco. I worked in Silicon Valley, but I worked in consumer internet companies, what we think of as the sexy elements of tech. And I, in a normal year, I am in the Bay Area around once every quarter to spend, you know, some time chatting with different technology folks. One of the things I'm astonished by is how bifurcated Silicon Valley has become. Really, the consumer internet people who are driving so many of the interesting headlines at companies like Google and Facebook really have no conception or understanding or interest in the semiconductor companies like Intel or Broadcom or Applied Materials. They are really, you know, not even talking to each other. And so I think it is still the case that, you know, if you are a smart Stanford grad, if you're an Ivy League grad, there is still much more appeal in working at big banks like, I dare say, DBS than at a less sexy company like Applied Materials, whom I bet one's mother has probably not heard of. And so, you know, if you have, Timer, you might agree with me here, we don't need that many more smart minds in asset allocation. Maybe we should be doing much more science and technology instead.
It's, you know, it's just a stark, harsh reality. You're right. But of course, you know, those who have been on the consumer end of the computer also have done very well in the last 20, 30 years, the ones who work for Google and so on. So I'd like to think that, especially out of business school, I think in the recent years, we have seen more people going in the tech world, but perhaps the bifurcation you're talking about is a fascinatingly disturbing insight, which is the innards of the internet and the computer world, everything that sort of runs the world is still not being serviced adequately by the fine minds, whereas everybody is the shinier part of the tech world. So Dan, you have sort of given us a sense of why a company like TSMC, which has deep experience as well as, you know, deep pool of capital, can be at the frontier of chip manufacturing. I just want you to give us a sense of, you know, what that frontier means. Is it the case that Moore's law has been exhausted and we're not really doubling processor speed anymore? And is it also the case that do we need to double the speed of processor every 18 months?
The question on Moore's Law is still a little bit controversial. There are a lot of skeptics now of Moore's Law, but there are also a lot of defenders who of Moore's Law who point out correctly that Moore's Law has died a thousand times in the newspapers and in analyst reports. And so far, it still looks like it is going. But I think the bulk of the evidence is on the side of the skeptics who are not so sure that Moore's Law has many years left to go. And, the way that I think about this is that you're right, first of all, that, maybe we don't need so many advanced chips for the most cutting edge processes. So, if you take a look at what constitute the most advanced chips today, a lot of it is made up of smartphone processors, especially iPhone processors. And smartphones have really driven basically a lot of the investment in semiconductors over the last decade, really since Apple's iPhone in 2008. And so many smartphones now, I think, we know that smartphones are have been a declining industry. For the last 4 years, smartphone sales, shipment sales have actually continuously declined. And it's not very clear that for even these new AI chips, these server chips, as far as I can tell, a lot of these are manufactured at 14 nanometers or 12 nanometers. They're not necessarily using 3-nanometer processes for Amazon's new server chips. And so Moore's Law is also a reflection of different economic processes. So if basically each of these fabs costs a lot more money, say on the scale of $20 billion each, and there's a little bit less, fewer use cases, at least as far as we can tell at the moment, I'm not really sure that this will have a great deal of room to run. And that's especially the case if you buy into the hype around 5G. So now I don't really buy the hype around 5G, but if you do, and you think that there's going to be a semiconductor in my pen, there's going to be a semiconductor in my lamp, well, you don't really necessarily need the most cutting edge chips and a traffic light. And so a lot of these trailing edge technologies will be good enough for a lot of the things that we want to do going forward.
Okay. And again, I'm just so captivated by the $20, $30 billion numbers because they're just so large. It's hard to get my mind around it. How long does it take for TSMC to make profit out of that huge investment?
Right. This is going to take, I think it takes them a couple of years. First of all, to have the facility up and running, I believe the usual figure is around, at least 3 years from greenfield investment to actually get this going. The good news for so many of these companies is that, the World Semiconductor Trade Council has done these very exquisite forecasts. There's a lot of forecasts about how much consumer demand there will be for different, smartphones, for example. And so I believe that they are able more or less to figure out the capital commitment that meets, for example, Apple's forecasts. And then they have some way to, smooth out the uncertainty and then smooth out the costs so that the time doesn't take far too long.
Okay, but we still have, I think the phrase that you used earlier was, fabless foundries that, many American companies in particular would rather be on the design side than the manufacturing side. And I was wondering whether the fact that, it takes a while and forecast at the end of the day, there is some uncertainty and you're parking billions of dollars in place. So maybe you are better off just outsourcing it to Foxconn or rather TSMC or somebody else to make it, as opposed to making it with getting your hands dirty.
That's sort of the very quintessential American attitude that you've articulated there, Timur, that, why should they get their hands dirty? Why should they, engage in this incredible capital expenditure when, those people in Asia can just do that work. This is off your own balance sheet. They prove themselves pretty good at it. And basically at this point, the companies in Asia are getting a pretty good deal out of it themselves as well, mostly because, TSMC is just so dominant. It is no longer really has much competition at all on the high end. And so it took a while for this model really to work out. But at this point, it can be a very profitable company indeed.
Right. But at the same time, we read about Apple wanting to build their own chips. So is the trend, at least if not getting reversed, but somewhat getting challenged in certain sectors?
I'm not sure that I'm aware of that news. We know that Apple is very extensively designing its chips. The iPhone processors are certainly Apple's, and Apple is now through the M1 chip increasingly designing more chips for laptops and for PCs. But I think for as far as I can tell, it is still going to be relying on TSMC to manufacture. It doesn't need to get its hands so dirty as to engage in the direct manufacturing itself.
Okay, so that A14 chip and the Bionic, these are designed by Apple, but not manufactured by Apple.
Correct. Just like a Qualcomm and NVIDIA chip are designed by these firms and manufactured by TSMC.
Yeah, like my phone says, designed in Silicon Valley. Oh, no, it says Sunnyvale or something, but it's, of course, made entirely in Asia. Okay, we have not talked about China in depth, and you're talking to us from Shanghai, and I'm very curious to hear your take on sort of China's journey in this area and where they are and where they're going.
Sure. Well, so China is now pretty good at designing chips. So I mentioned Huawei earlier designing pretty sophisticated chips for its own smartphones. And we also see a couple of other success areas. There are certain AI chips now that China is taking a crack at. There are certain server chips that Huawei has taken a crack at. And we know that this is sort of a trivial application, but crypto chips is something that a lot of Chinese firms were really good at. Although, it's trivial, but now maybe also quite lucrative to be in this tidy little business. China lacks manufacturing capabilities. So China's manufacturing leader is SMIC, S-M-I-C, which is roughly at least 5 years behind TSMC in terms of capabilities. But, 5 years behind TSMC is not exactly catastrophic. That's basically where the iPhone 6, still an amazing sales, the product for Apple a few years ago. That's not, I would say, a horrible position for China to be in. And China is now ramping up its production of memory chips. So it is now a bit more sophisticated on NAND chips, a bit behind in DRAM, which is far more valuable. And this is where the Korean companies really have a lock on the market. But, most industry observers basically think that China is going to be a fairly important player in memory in the next few years, just in the same way that Japan and Korea both figured out semiconductors after figuring out memory. Where China is really behind are the capital equipment to actually produce the chips, as well as the software to design the chips. This is, again, mostly an American affair with some Japanese and Dutch participation here. And this is where, China really needs to figure out this very science-based process to manufacture these machines that actually produce the chips.
And do you see evidence of progress? I mean, are they, writing papers in scientific journals showing that, there's domestic grown know-how, and are the Chinese engineers having been involved in not the cutting edge, but at least somewhat close to cutting edge manufacturing for a decade, are now getting better at these things?
There are certainly green shoots. So there are Chinese companies that are have some part of the domestic market for semiconductor manufacturing equipment. As best as I can tell, around 10% of the production equipment sold in China are made by Chinese headquartered firms. But these are mostly, very lagging edge technology. These do not come anything close to what Japan or Holland or the US is able to make. A lot of these are subsidy driven. So when I speak with Chinese semiconductor firms, they would tell me, yeah, sure, the government bought one of these for us, but we don't even really want to turn these on and learn how to use these things because they are just so far behind. But the real question for me is not how far behind is China today, but how quickly can it catch up, because it is making very intensive efforts to, catch up to the technological frontier on this very critical technology.
Did Donald Trump's trade war set things back for China in a meaningful manner?
Absolutely. So President Trump has signed executive orders or targeted for sanctions pretty much all of China's leading technology firms. If you ask me, what are the most important technology companies in China? I would say these are names like Huawei, first of all, and then also Alibaba, Tencent, SMIC, and ByteDance. And, you know, pretty much all of these companies have faced some form of U.S. sanctions, except for Alibaba. In this case, it is the Chinese government that's doing the punishment. But, you know, all of these other firms have faced some form of U.S. sanctions. The impact for Tencent and ByteDance is not very severe. Basically, it's a minor product offering of theirs that's being tied up in the U.S., and these orders have been halted by federal courts. The impact might be quite a bit more severe on SMIC, although it's still a little bit too early to tell what that sanctions order means. When it comes to Huawei, the impact is pretty clear. Huawei's major business lines are smartphones, which made up around 55% of revenue in 2019, base stations, which made up 35%, and then enterprise, which are things like cloud and surveillance systems, which made up 10%. And we know now that Huawei's smartphone sales are very deeply being squeezed. I think the forecast I saw for this year is that Huawei will only be able to ship around a third to a half of the smartphones it sold in 2020, which was already fairly low. Its base stations, I think, cannot be manufactured in much more quantity by the end of 2021. And its enterprise segment is doing okay, but it's its smallest revenue segment. So Huawei is now in very deep trouble. And China's most advanced semiconductor maker is in very deep trouble. And then the U.S. government has also issued light sanctions on a company like Xiaomi as well. And so, you know, a lot of these giants are really getting caught up. Now, you know, the interesting part is, you know, again, what happens in the next few years? I think that President Trump has really delivered a lot of setbacks to these Chinese companies in the short term. But I think in the longer term, this really drives a determination in China to master a lot of these different technologies.
Yeah, that's one narrative that I heard a lot in 2019, that in a way, the tech war was like a Pearl Harbor moment for China, that, you know, they would not suffer these indignities and they would double up on building more homegrown capabilities. Dan, earlier when you were talking about Chinese firms getting subsidies from the government, I was sort of wondering about the U.S. firms getting subsidies from the U.S. government. I mean, can you envision a scenario where national security concerns sort of nudge the Pentagon towards subsidizing manufacturing of fabs in the U.S.?
I can not only imagine it, Tamar, I can see it basically right now. So last year, Congress passed the CHIPS Act, C-H-I-P-S Act, as part of the National Defense Authorization Act, which promises very large subsidies for manufacturers, semiconductor manufacturers, to be based in the U.S. And I had to take a look again at basically exactly what is the structure of these subsidies. But last I saw, you know, there was something like, you know, up to $3 billion that the Congress would authorize the Department of Commerce to give to any semiconductor manufacturer that will develop in the U.S. And so now we have stories like TSMC building a new fab in Arizona, where there are already quite a lot of pretty substantial semiconductor capabilities. We also see a company like Samsung, which has promised to invest more in, I think, Austin to produce more. In addition, Intel and Micron are still very, very important semiconductor manufacturers. So I think U.S. capabilities here, at least on manufacturing, have seen better days, but I think there will be enough capacity in the country that will, I think, train up a lot of talent to make the U.S. manufacturing sector great again, at least with respect to chips.
Right. I just saw this morning that the U.K. is liberalizing its visa requirement for foreigners with tech background. I can easily see under Biden administration in the next few years, you know, again, like a tech visa type thing where, you know, if you have advanced degrees from a grade school in the U.S., you get an automatic green card and work in one of these companies, which I think, you know, is a win-win for both that student and for the US. So I'm pretty sure something like that would happen. Dan, the question again goes back to the setbacks that we have seen with the Intels of the world. And I think you just touched on the uncertainty as well, that just giving subsidy or just throwing lots of money at it may not be sufficient, because we are, I mean, it's not just making a widget, it is a lot of, as you said, computer science and chemical engineering and solid state physics, all of those combined. So, but you think that the US can sort of trace back its leadership in a matter of years, or it's not a done deal?
I think there is a pretty good chance that the US can reclaim leadership. And so if I take a look at the customers of semiconductors, these are still, you know, the US is still a major tech leader, even if it's in consumer internet, which I enjoy a little bit less. But, you know, you have firms like Amazon and Microsoft being major purchasers of, you know, servers for their cloud businesses. You have you know, companies like Facebook and Google doing a lot of artificial intelligence in terms of PyTorch as well as TensorFlow, doing quite a lot of having very sophisticated chips needs. And then most of all, you have Apple, which is a very good and big customer for various different types of chips. So, you know, a lot of these chips will be embedded in servers that will go up to, let's say, Washington State or Oregon. They don't need to be, you know, there's already a very large pool of customers. In addition, when you combine that with the fact that the US is still a leader in a lot of semiconductor manufacturing technologies, in terms of being able to produce that capital equipment, I don't think that it is too much of a stretch to imagine that as the US gets much more intent on cultivating its semiconductor base again, you know, it will become very good. You know, I think what would be more challenging is if you ask the US to become really good at something like consumer electronics, which is mostly located today in Shenzhen. That's a tougher ask, but given that there are so many US firms which are already customers and have competences in this technology, I don't think it's too tough to imagine.
Right, and I think, again, the national security concerns, I guess, are far more paramount than wanting to build a TV at home versus it being built in China or Vietnam. Dan, in the course of the last few years, we heard about this risk of this bifurcation of the global supply chain, one sort of centered around China, one centered outside of China. At the chip level, if you indeed see, you know, TSMC sort of, you know, gravitating towards the US orbit and making the cutting edge chips for US companies, and also some of the chips being made in the US, and China sort of gets left behind. And you know, you're talking about 4 or 5 years at least before they catch up, maybe even longer. Then aren't we seeing seeds of some serious geopolitical tension where China is sort of left out of the really good stuff and the rest of the world is sort of not buying some of the things that are made in China?
Well, I would say that we are a bit past the seeds of geopolitical tension. We these seeds have already sprouted in the last few years under, you know, President Trump, as well as a more hawkish Beijing as well. So, you know, I think it is an important thing to consider whether China will get left behind. Timur, you offered earlier the historical comparison of Pearl Harbor. I think the more apt comparison is something like Sputnik. So, you know, the U.S. has mostly triggered a Sputnik moment in China by continuously kneecapping leading Chinese firms like Huawei. And instead of really realizing its own Sputnik moment, the U.S. has triggered one in China, which it sort of laid bare to both the Chinese people, as well as more importantly, the Chinese leadership, that for all of China's vaunted technology triumphs in things like mobile payments or high-speed rail, these are really not sufficient in the most important technology, semiconductors, which is underpins so many of the other digital successes. And so, you know, I think China is going to become very, very intent on trying to figure out these different technologies. You know, there are so many data points that I can point to, but, you know, to give one example of how much the Chinese leadership is thinking about technology now, you know, at the end of the year, the state holds something called the Central Economic Work Conference. conference, in which it sets basically the 8 major economic pieces of work that the government will undertake over the next year. And the very top priority in 2020 was for China to do science and technology as the very top of the 8 items. And as far as I can tell, China has never broken out science and technology independently in any of these Central Economic Work Conference reports. To see it being broken out as the very top item, you know, is very, very surprising to me. That just shows how China is now in very much of a whole of society effort to, you know, have the government provide leadership as well as coordinating services to its leading firms like Huawei, which are deeply suffering now. And then they are very, very intent to figure these things out. And China's endowment, I would say, is not terribly poor. There is still a huge market here. There's a lot of growth. The Chinese technology companies are, you know, quite a bit behind American companies, I would say. But, you know, they are I would say, broadly still ahead, you know, in some ways than Europe and Japan and everyone else. And so, and there's also quite a lot of science training in China. Probably the quality is not the same level as Caltech or Stanford or MIT. But, you know, there's just, you know, what China lacks in quality, it can probably partially make up in quantity. There are just so many grads of science programs here. And so, you know, add up all of these things together, I think, you know, you can't count the US out, you can't count China out. Both of these will be racing ahead, and I think it will be a fairly close race.
Dan, I'll share with you an anecdote. A friend of mine who has taught both at Harvard and at Tsinghua says that in terms of intellectual capability, the students are identical, but in terms of ambition, the Tsinghua students are at a whole different level than the American students who basically want to get an Ivy League tenure tech job, whereas these guys want to take over departments and create their own universities. So, when you talk about quantity and drive, I certainly think that, you know, there is a lot of tailwind in China in that regard. You know, I sort of, you know, take your point about the Sputnik moment versus the Pearl Harbor moment. I brought up Pearl Harbor simply because I felt that the attack was so pronounced from the U.S. in the last 4 years that even though the Chinese, I guess, had a sense of dread given Trump's pre-election rhetoric, did not expect it to be that hard and that sort of furious. Whereas I felt that the 2025 plan that they announced even before Trump came in was in a way sort of a galvanizing Sputnik processes for them. But I fully take your point that this sort of social call right now to sort of, you know, line up all the resources to get tech self-sufficiency is certainly, you know, very, very visible in China. Dan, you have been extremely helpful in shedding light on this. I want to talk to you about something very current, it may not be that relevant for your day-to-day work, but, you know, for us and for the rest of the world, this ongoing chip shortages, and as a result, it's sort of spilling over to parts shortages in auto industry and electronics industry and so on. Has that spilled over to China? I mean, when you are sort of talking to your counterparts in Shanghai, do you hear ripple effects of that? And do you have any light to shed as to what's going on?
Sure. Well, I think it was China that experienced this phenomenon first. I remember picking up news reports in November when the Chinese auto manufacturers started saying, well, we're lacking semiconductors. And, you know, at the time, this was not broadly reported. Many people wasn't really aware that such a thing was going on. And in fact, a lot of the Chinese media stated that, oh my goodness, this is yet another conspiracy orchestrated by the United States meant to hurt Chinese companies. But then, you know, the situation ended up being like something like COVID, in which China was the first country really struck, and then sort of was a much bigger problem everywhere else. Now we see major European and American auto manufacturers, you know, complaining about this. And I think, you know, the Chinese commentary is not quite right here. There is nothing nefarious about this problem. This was simply a mismatch of supply and demand, in which auto parts were always sort of at the lower, at the bottom of the totem pole in terms of allocation for manufacturing. Now, a lot of these parts companies simply aren't paying, you know, Apple levels in order to get their chips. I believe the auto industry, which I don't really cover, had forecasted how robust auto demand would be from consumers. And then in addition, we had a couple of idiosyncratic things, mostly related to China, in which Huawei locked up a lot of allocation for the actual manufacturers because it could imminently no longer get chips past September of 2020. SMIC was also designated to the entity list, which has put a little bit of a crimp in its ability to keep expanding. As best as I can tell, this auto chip shortage will last for a few more months, possibly through the end of the year. But this is this to me is more of a anomalous cyclical mismatch rather than anything very structurally deeper with the industry, even though it is really concentrating a lot of minds now, especially on reason number 5,000 that semiconductors are really important.
Right, indeed. I hope, and I think I concur that it's probably largely idiosyncratic factors. 6 months' time, we probably would not be talking about it as much. Finally, Dan, coming back to that sort of civilizational conflict between the US and China, we have Joe Biden as president. Temperatures are going to be a little lower, hopefully. Do you see some space for constructive engagement in the area of tech, or it's just way too sensitive and the two countries' militaries are involved, and that is one area where Biden really can't climb down?
Very difficult to tell. So we know from President Biden's first actions, it's about exactly a month since he first entered the White House, that he has not been very deeply conciliatory against China. His comments, his focuses have been pretty hawkish still. In addition, he has not relaxed very many constraints. But I think it can still be a little bit too early to tell about what exactly he wants to do. The more benign view here is that, first of all, it's simply a matter of domestic politics that he cannot let go of these issues on China too quickly. And then also he won't have too many of his assistant secretaries installed in departments like Commerce or Treasury or Defense, at least for a few more months. Probably these positions still won't be filled until at least through the summer. And so, I think there is some hope at least that Biden can walk back a few of these different areas, mostly due to business lobbying. Now, I'm here in Shanghai. There are so many companies, American companies in China, who would say that, China was responsible for pretty much 90 to almost the entire profit of the group. Without China, there wouldn't have been any profits in the group company this year. There is a lot to lose if you are a semiconductor company, if you can't access China. Financials especially are also very keen to access China. And so I expect that the Biden administration will be somewhat responsive to these concerns, but it is too soon to tell how much that, how responsive exactly they will be. As you said, I think you put it very aptly that things will cool down relative to Trump, but maybe if it cools down and everything sort of crystallizes and not too much gets walked back, that is also a potential scenario to me.
Yeah, that's a sobering reality. Dan, I can't tell you how thankful I am for your brilliant insights. I think our listeners are going to benefit tremendously from hearing your views on this incredibly important topic. So again, thank you very much.
Well, Timur, thank you again for the invitation.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks to our listeners too. What a fascinating subject. Kopi Time was produced by Martin Tucky, Daisy Sharma, and Violet Lee provided additional assistance. It is for information only and does not represent any trade recommendations. All 47 episodes of Kopi Time are available on YouTube and on all major podcast platforms, including Apple, Google, and Spotify. As for our research publications, webinars, and live streams, you can find them all by Googling DBS Research Library. Have a great day.